everything is storytelling, apart from storytelling, and that's about people. It is just about driving connections, telling great stories in great ways, and just enabling people to feel a part of that, feel involved and part of a community. Because I think at its worst, sport assumes that everybody bloody loves sport.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly and I'm delighted to be bringing you another in a series of conversations with journalists and authors, broadcasters, filmmakers, executives, innovative creators and campaigners about the changing relationship between sport and the stories and communities that build around it. Hello to any new listeners. Welcome back to those of you who've checked out either of the first couple of episodes. Hope you've enjoyed it so far. If you have, early days for this, but if you have, please do subscribe, leave a rating and a nice review, share links, just generally spread the word. It all makes the podcast easier for new audiences to find. Speaking of which, how did you become a sports fan? I'm assuming if you're listening to this, that you probably are. It's a question that I kind of ask of everybody at the end of each conversation, and it's been a fundamental challenge for most of the sports organizations I've covered in the past as an industry journalist. And the truth is, particularly if you're a sports fan since childhood, you might not remember. That discovery might have been accidental, and it almost certainly happened in a media environment that doesn't really exist in the same way today. This is the first in a couple of early chats that I'll be having about how sport can reach kids and younger people through its storytelling. My guest this time is Stuart Rosen. He's the founder of Lucky Socks Media, a consultancy that was created to help sports bodies and brands develop strategies and programming that connect with those young audiences as they grow up. Stuart's worked with the likes of England Rugby, Chelsea, World Sailing, UEFA, and many more. And before creating Lucky Socks, he spent several years at the BBC, where he was the digital editor for BBC Sport and head of discovery for CBeebies and CBBC. And he's a published children's author himself, releasing Izzy and the Tumble Thunder a couple of years ago. We talked about what's changed in how kids find sport in the digital era, how they take ownership of their own stories and communities, what sports organizations can do to become more relevant to youngsters at different ages, and how they can forge links between media, participation and lasting fandom. Plenty of food for thought, for sure, about how anyone becomes a fan of anything in 2025. So let's listen in. Here's Stuart Rosen. So you're one of the cohort who moved up to Salford when the BBC did the big split. What was that, 15 years ago, or what's your...
So my story is 2011, I moved to Salford, but I didn't move up, I moved across. So right. I am a proud northerner who's never worked or lived in that south. Whether I ever will, who knows? But no, I was one of the first 100 members of the BBC in Media City when it opened in May 2011.
Wow.
Still being built. There wasn't a pub on site. There was, not sure if there was a shop, there might have been a booth, but there was a whole load of stuff that wasn't there. And where Coronation Street is now was literally a brownfield. So it was like proper early days of the project.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that done? Like, it's hard to judge the impact of any of these big scale moves or what have you, but yeah. What, in your experience, has been the effect of the industry up in that part of the world of having the BBC on your doorstep there?
Manchester, to me, and I think about when I can only really judge from when I arrived in 2011 to now in 2025, but feels like a boomtown place to be in a whole load of ways. And I'm sure that the BBC played a huge role in that. And just from a very basic visible point of view, for anybody who's like familiar with Manchester, there used to be like, there was one skyscraper for 10 years and it was the Hilton and everything else. And now there are just huge projects going on all over the place. So it looks very visibly different. Now there's a kind of like Manc Chatham kind of vibe going on. And, you know, if you think even post-COVID around Media City, and Media City's got a very different vibe, I think, to it had in like 2019. But there are a whole cohort of support companies around there. So, you know, there was a couple of thousand BBC staff, there's like 1,000 ITV staff, and then there are graphics companies, kit companies, post-production companies that have just sprung up behind it in Media City. And let's face it, 20 years ago, that was like a derelict site. So Turns out that people who work in the media generally tend to earn more than like the national average. So that whole kind of, you know, having those hundreds of jobs and opportunities for people who would either never have made it down south or might have never considered a life in the media. So I think the impact has been huge on Salford and Manchester.
Yeah. And obviously, you're now the founder of one of those new companies in Lucky Socks, and we'll unpack kind of what you guys do and also what your kind of past in the BBC has taught you as we go. But let's talk a little bit more kind of conceptually to start with about the idea of, you know, getting younger people and kids interested in sport. I mean, what are some of the triggers that you find? What are some of the things that activate that interest in the first place?
I think it's fascinating. It's just a fascinating area, one I'm really passionate about, you know. So we are passionate about engaging children clearly in the digital space because there's a lot of that going on, but with the full end of basically getting more kids moving. You know, we want to get kids more active. We know we've got a national obesity crisis, national inactivity crisis. And working both in BBC Sport and then in BBC Children, so CBeebies and CBBC, really kind of made me more passionate about that audience, I think, than I'd been previously. And the things that we see so from our work is you have people coming at it from a whole range of different areas, right? Some of them, they might want to get into the kids space because, frankly, they want to make some money out of it. You know, they want to monetize through shirts or merch or whatever it is. A lot of our work is through the likes of like NGBs, where there's a bit more of a public purpose. And I guess this is the BBC chip that's probably, you know, still writ large through me, right? It's the whole sense of just having that wider public service remit. So the NGBs are, you know, they've got to get kids moving. They've got to get kids involved in the long term, whether or not it's fandom for their sport or playing their sport or, you know, just following it. And also the thing with NGBs and those kind of public bodies is that's where their funding comes from. You know, so if you are one of these sort of national governing bodies where you're taking in so much money from the government and you've got participation numbers falling off a cliff, well, you've also got an added incentive, you know, that you've kind of got to sort that out. So it's a fascinating space for a whole ton of reasons.
I mean, the thing that, you know, we were chatting about this a little bit before we started recording, but, you know, it feels to me from the outside of this particular conversation, although I've got a toddler at home, and so I'm starting to observe the ways that media kind of the media diet or the media the way kids discover media has changed through the kind of on demand era.
The
discovery of sport has got to be affected by that. When you think of a generation before, it would have been a lot around free to air TV. It would have been a lot around maybe children's programming perhaps, but I think it was that live sport component and that sport being part of the national conversation that you kind of gravitate towards at a certain age. That feels like it's going to be not relevant, but it's going to be less of a component of the journey that kids make, particularly to watching sport. Obviously, you know, those who are lucky enough to play certain games at school will find it that way. But what's the macro view of that you've come across?
You're right, because I mean, I'm 47 now. When I was, I remember coming back home from school in the late 80s, early 90s, and it was like, in the summer, you stick the live test match on, and the first thing you do is put CFAX on, and you go 301, and you work your way through. And like, discovery was very different of sport then. I think now that everybody's in a competition for probably media time and, you know, physical attention, there are just so many different choices. You know, there are so many choices within this thing. And there are so many choices in the real world in a way that there frankly wasn't before. I think though that the role that sport plays like in kids' lives is still probably as important as it was. It's just the consumption levels are totally different. So, you know, we know that children watch more on-demand content than they watch live content. And that is in a world of like wall-to-wall live sport. You know, if you've got, whether or not you've got all of the subscriptions or frankly, you've got a dodgy stick, then it's wall-to-wall sport wherever you can find it. But it's almost like lost its sense of being special as a result of that, I think. You know, it's not like back in the day when it was actually quite a treat to be able to see some live sport. So I think more things were built around it. But, you know, what that has led to and the growth of mobile phones and obviously social media and everything else is that you're now in this competition for like just making an impact, but you're also in a competition for creating engagement. Whereas before, everybody was just broadcasting. So they're just shouting at you, basically, from that little box in the corner of your room. They're just shouting at you and hoping that you're there. Well, actually now, you know, Gen Z or Gen A, whichever one you want to talk about, they have grown up wanting to be part of it. They want to be part of a engaging, participatory conversation because that's what they're used to. You know, they don't want to be broadcast at anymore. They want to feel part of something. So tapping into that is sort of crucial for organizations.
Mm. And would you say that is that the biggest change when you think back at your time, when you think back over your time at the BBC, mm-hmm. you know, you were there 15 years, 20 years?
Yeah, 15 years.
Yeah. In various different departments. So news, children's and sport.
Yeah.
You know, they're all quite distinct areas and we'll probably come onto that as well, kind of the way that those three types of media operate. But, you know, they're all areas where that change has been pretty pronounced in the digital era. I mean, how did you register that? What were some of the biggest changes that you saw in that time?
I think there are some numbers that just highlight it. So for any of us who, you know, lived through the 2010s and were an adult during the 2010s, we saw the massive infiltration of smartphones. So, you know, in the 2000s, it had been like WAP enabled phones, whatever it was, I can't remember, where it's literally, you know, you were playing Snake and you were sending messages. And, you know, I was explaining to my stepson the other day, who's 11, that back in the day, it used to cost you 10p per message and like blew his brain. He just couldn't get his head around it. So if you think of, I'll give you an example of how it changed in the 2010s. And I think this is how all of our working lives have changed if we're in the media and we're not in like making big telly programs. When I arrived at BBC Sport as the website editor in 2011, it was like primarily a desktop proposition. And mm-hmm. when we did London 2012, I think 80% of the traffic was desktop, 20% was mobile. And we had about 250,000 followers on social media, most of whom were on Twitter. And for the London Olympics, I put journalists on what we call Twitter shifts, like literally breaking news shifts on Twitter. And let's just say there was a particularly negative reaction to the people who were doing that. They were like, what is this shit? This is not journalism. Like just tweeting a breaking news flash about a gold medal or whatever. Fast forward 4 years. And in between time, in 2013, we put together the first social media team in BBC Sport. And we brought a lot of your listeners will be familiar with Chris Hurst, actually just won Consultant of the Year at the Sports Industry Awards. He was the BBC's first social media editor. We brought him over from the ICC. And in between 2013 and 2016, the growth of social media was phenomenal. So from 2012 in the London Olympics, we went from 250,000, 300,000 followers on social media through to Rio, where we had 30 million. And for Rio, something like 70 or 80% of the traffic was mobile, 30% was desktop. So it was a total flip just in that 4 or 5 year period from desktop-based proposition. Social media was big and a big part of what we was doing and it was just burgeoning to like mobile was everything. And what that forced us to do was moving with consumption patterns was basically change some of our storytelling. And you see this, you know, we changed at the time how we did like live pages, which are massively popular on BBC Sport and on BBC News. You know, at the time when we first started, you know, they'd been doing live pages for years and they'd always been massively popular, but they always felt like live pages written by the sports website team rather than a live page that represented all of this amazing content and journalism around BBC Sport. So we properly worked really hard to make them feel bigger, make them feel like a live radio show, effectively, when they were just pulling in the best of that great punditry and images and everything else. So there were massive changes in how you had to tell stories for what was primarily, you know, become a mobile audience.
Mm. And how did you think about that across the three departments that you worked in during your time at the BBC?
So I did it mainly within sports. So sports, the obvious one, because I was in charge of sort of the sport website when we launched the app ahead of 2012. And then we changed the way we did loads of things. So we talked about live pages, but also the way that people started to consume video is very different. And, you know, that went from a desktop proposition to a mobile proposition. The whole sense of like catch up, you know, mm-hmm. I remember when we were doing Rio, we always sort of said it was either a stay up or catch up proposition. So people were either staying up late or they were waking up early at 8 o'clock in the morning and going, right, what did I miss while I was asleep? So having a proper sense of like a catch up, mobile catch up proposition, whether it was in video or text. And really basic level, we even changed things like Premier League match reports. So there was a time when a reporter would just do a 1,000 word Premier League match report like they used to do in newspapers. And actually, we really had to challenge ourselves to go, how do we make this more of a mobile phone proposition? You know, thinking about like modular content, interactive elements and stuff like that. So within sport, that was the main thing. Within children's, when I got there, where suddenly you're talking about like 0 to 6s who might be on their tablets, or 6 to 12-year-olds who are consuming things in a very different way. Like, you know, and then you've got the elements of compliance and safeguarding and a load more responsibility to think about. It really was, you know, hugely different again to what we'd done in sport. So when we launched, for example, CBBC on like TikTok and Instagram, we were going, well, our audience might not be the 6 to 12-year-old audience that it is on the TV. It might be a slightly lapsed audience or an older end of that audience. So what I think it sort of gave us from the world of going at BBC Sport, it was like, right, we're either on the website or we're on social. By the time I got to BBC Children's in 2018, it wasn't like it's either on mobile or social. It was like, well, it might be it's tablet or it's mobile or it's Instagram or it's TikTok or it's CBeebies grown-ups where we're targeting adults. And social media became like 8 different things rather than just kind of one catch-all, as it probably had been for a bit before.
Yeah, and I think that probably would be the media environment that people are familiar with now, right? Which is also the one that presents the central challenge, which is your audience is everywhere, but also you don't quite know where they are. You don't quite know where to apply resources. And when you're thinking about young audiences in particular, that discovery piece changes. I mean, I think back to the 90s, and it was, as you say, Test match cricket on all summer, but it was also on straight after the holiday programming. A block had finished on children's television, and you know, similar with Grandstand at the weekend and whatever it would have been, Live and Kicking or something at that point. How do you process it differently? We'll get, I guess, to talk about Lucky Socks now, because you know this is now the piece that you're helping sports bodies with. How do you process that challenge differently when you are talking about younger audiences?
Well, I think it's understanding that the storytelling rules have almost changed. And I don't prescribe to this kind of idea that children don't have an attention span and that they, you know, they only want 7-second videos and everything else. Now, to a certain extent, they do, right? Of course, they like that kind of dopamine hit, and there's all sorts of kind of inherent dangers with social platforms and everything else. But I always say this to people is that in the 90s, not so much in the 80s, but in the 90s, we all watch You've Been Framed, right? And You've Been Framed as a show was massive. And all You've Been Framed was a constant string of dopamine-hitting funny videos, just like that. Mm-hmm. Now, if a mobile phone had been invented back then, that would have been social media content. So the psychological need of like, whether or not it's younger audiences or children, hasn't changed. What has changed is the delivery mechanism. And what we've got at Lucky Socks, based on sort of the experience that we've had working across, you know, me and the sort of people that I bring into the network, working across BBC Children, so CBBC, CBeebies, all ages, and the quality, you know, for adults and young adults of BBC Sport, is that we have like a five-step sequential model. So if we are working with, and we've done this now with BBC News, Welsh Rugby, England, Welsh Football and England Rugby, and a few others, and we'll go in and we've got basically a young audience framework that we work through, and whether or not we're assessing what people are doing to look for opportunities and improvements, or whether or not we're just starting from scratch with a new young audience strategy. And it's fairly basic, but there's lots of thinking behind it. The first one is like, is it fun? Is it entertaining? You know, it's all about storytelling, but it has to be fun storytelling and everything that contains. And get that one right, and you have a plan for that one. It's then, is it right? And that sense of being right is everything from, is it appropriate? Is it safe? Is it compliant for the language that you're talking to? You know, does it fit if you're talking to preschoolers? Does it fit like alongside the EYFS kind of curriculum stuff? You know, life stages and developmental stages. And a good way of thinking about some of that is like the Antiques Roadshow is appropriate for children, but it's neither relevant nor interesting if you're eight, but it's appropriate, you know, because the language and everything else is fine. So that's kind of the difference. And that can be in digital products or in content. And once you've nailed that, then it's like, and this is where you get into a bit more into like the modern world of going, is it right? Is it rewarded? Is it, so you've got, is it fun? Is it right? And is it rewarded? And the rewarding bit can be like in the digital world or in the physical world. So, you know, we've now got, as we said earlier, a generation of children who have grown up wanting to participate in what you're doing. They want a voice, they want to share, like, comment, make their own content, whatever it might be. So that participatory element of what you're doing and the engagement element is absolutely huge. So you want to drive habits and you want people to come back to you, but what we don't want you to do is drive addiction. Mm-hmm. So that real fine balance of working out the right level of rewarding. Once you've done that, then you go, does it inspire? Now, it might, in a sports sense, it might inspire you to go and check out the rules, maybe watch a game, hopefully go and try it, you know, get off your backside and be a bit more active. And it might then, as part of that, make you a fan. So there's all different ways that you can inspire people. Everybody's going to play it. You might just follow it. You might be a fan of it. But that's what it needs to do. And how do you cater for that when those things happen? Once you've done that, is what's the value? What's the value back to the organization? Now, the value back to the organization might be a massive growth in participation numbers. It might be a reputational change because you're doing it for CSR reasons. It might be that you've made you managed to monetize it. So you've made a big dirty pile of cash out of shirt sales or merch or whatever it is. But that five-step framework is like what we take everybody through in the sense of, these are the things you need to think about if you're looking at a young audience. The beauty of that, of course, is that the way to answer all of those needs a level of expertise. And what I see quite a lot of is people going, oh, yeah, we can do young audiences because we're on TikTok or whatever. It's, you know, it's a bit throwaway. But I always say that there's a reason that CBeebies exists, and there's a reason that Disney exists, Nickelodeon, and that is because you have people within those jobs and within those organizations who are storytelling experts for children. What we do is we go, right, we've got storytelling expertise and we'll put platform expertise alongside kind of sports expertise and we'll bring all of them together.
Yeah. What made you think that this was the approach, going the consultancy or the kind of agency route? Was there ever a point where you thought maybe there's a function at an organization like the BBC that could work to develop these kind of young audience strategies with sports partners? Or maybe I'm trying to think who would be big enough and on the rights holder side, but a BOA or an FA or whoever. I mean, what was it that made you kind of go the lucky socks route in the end?
Well, it was quite interesting. So I guess when I left the Beeb, having done sport and children's, it felt very natural because I could see that everybody was frankly banging on about younger audiences and what do we do? And I felt like having, you know, so in my role at BBC Children's, I oversaw like everything from news round to all of the like social platforms through to like websites and the CBeebies apps and like iPlayer and TV schedule, and even things like bedtime stories. So you could see that there was a real drive to get involved and interested in youth audiences from external organizations, not just within the Beeb. And that felt like my sweet spot of like expertise and also passion point for me. You know, I'm passionate about getting more kids involved and more and active involved in sport. And when I first came out, I kind of worked as a consultant. And on some projects was almost working like an agency without working like an agency. So I'd go in and people would say, we need a plan. So you do the strokey beard bit and you work on a plan for them. And then the next question is, can you help us find the people to put the plan in progress? And you go, yeah, of course I can. And then you sort of pull in people from your network, but they're working for that organization rather than you. And then, you know, there were times when I was overseeing the content, but we were all working independently for the organization. And to be honest, I kind of thought there's a model here where you can be very, very flexible and go in and offer a whole range of services in that children and your audience's space. Now we can go in and we can help you work out what your strategy might be, no matter what age of children you're looking to reach and no matter what you're kind of trying to work out from it. At the same time, if we then decide that, well, the answer is to help you bring together a tender for an app or to make a content series, well, we can help you with that. And if it's, you know, content production is now what we're doing with the RFU. And then if we need to, we can pull the right people together to run the channels for you and publish the stuff. Mm-hmm. So we've got a range of expertise, and Lucky Socks is effectively an end-to-end agency of one. So it's got one member of staff, and that's me. at the moment, I'm running about 15 freelancers on different projects. So what we do is it makes us very fleet of foot. So it's small and nimble, but also what makes our kind of calling card is the fact that my network is mainly ex-BBC people. So if you want to work with Lucky Socks, then you know you're getting either like BBC level of content or products or whatever knowledge it is, or as we are on one of our other projects at the moment, you know, I'm working alongside Russell James, who's the former director of commercial and marketing at the ECB. And you're able to pull in like real C-suite experts. Now, Russell is absolutely brilliant what he does. And we've brought in a woman called Anna Shaw, who's also working with us, you know, but Russell knows loads of bits of commercial and marketing that I don't know. So you can look at a project and go, right, I can do this, but I need that and I need that. And you're able to bring people in and supplement. And actually, I think if I was running an agency of 10 staff, I think the offer would be fairly rigid. Mm-hmm. You know, you're right, well, this is the bit that we can do. But actually, because we're operating with freelancers and expertise and trusted networks, you're able to flex and take on different projects and go in different ways.
Sure. What about the need you found on the other side, or you found so far on the other side? How well set up are rights holders to hear this message? How receptive are they to it? And how well set up are they to deliver on it?
I don't think anybody, I haven't sat down with anybody, and I'm going, clearly, you know, I've been Lucky Socks over 2 years old. I haven't had a conversation with anybody where they've gone, we're not interested in younger audiences. Everybody's mm-hmm. interested in it. They know it's an issue. The only difference will be in whether or not you are, I don't know, a football club or a more commercial outfit. You might go, we're really interested in younger audiences, but it's number 5 on the priority list. Because before we get to that, we've got to sort out e-ticketing, our website, they've got frankly other things are on fire. The people who are most engaged with it are the ones where they are looking ahead maybe 3 and 5 years time and going, we know we've got a specific issue now, but if we don't put in a plan for both now and the longer term, then we're basically going to be up shit creek without a paddle. And that's what you find. And now the issue within that, and I don't think I'm doing a disservice to any like media setup within the sports industry, is that the majority of media outfits in everybody, from whether or not it's Man United to the FA to, I don't know, basketball or whatever, they're either massively under-resourced or, in a media sense, they're immature, but in an entity sense. I don't mean that they're immature individuals. Mm-hmm. As a business, it can be quite immature. Now, There are some who do it fantastically well, of course, right? But lots of the people that we speak to, you might have a fairly small media outfit, and none of them have ever done children's content before. And of course they haven't, because it's not why they were employed in the first place. So then to ask them to like suddenly, right, okay, you've got to go from doing content for your core audience, who might be like me and you, frankly, you've now got to start making content for nine-year-olds. That's quite a task to suddenly flip, you know, even no matter how good you are at content, to suddenly flip and then understand why nine-year-olds are so different and what's so different. So what Lucky Socks does is it kind of fills a gap, because we are a ready-made media kids department in whichever way you want us to flex. And that's the issue. The people who go, yeah, do you know what? We kind of have got this problem, but we also don't, we haven't got a plan because we don't know what we're trying to solve other than we just need to engage with more children.
Yeah. What are you able to work with that's there? And is there anything that's kind of surprised you with any of these organizations in terms of either the relationships they already have with younger parts of their community, even if they're not kind of media audiences, or just some aspect of their world that you can kind of use to fire kids' imaginations a little bit?
I think the key we've got when we go in is what, you know, what sport has got that lots of things down, and it's passion. Because I think the first thing that you want to do when you engage kids is to entertain them. You know, you want to make their faces move. You want to make them smile. And it's just like me and you are having this conversation, right? If we smile at each other, we're probably going to get on a bit better. And on a very basic level, you need to start a human conversation often through a digital device, you know, because that's the first step to engagement. And I wish it wasn't. I wish it was like we all just got them out on playing fields. But the reality is what you've got to do is you've got to start up an engaging relationship with them, probably in a digital space first, to grow reach, grow attribution, grow engagement with them and make them feel part of something, to then start steering them towards like the experiential stuff. You know, can you get them to a game where they get something where they actually physically get involved with something? And it's a bit like the work we're doing with England Rugby, where it's a project that will be launched in the autumn, so I'll be slightly vague about it. But what that's about inspiring kids to get involved at a young age with rugby. Now, how you do that is not by creating a training video that looks like a PE lesson that frankly bores the shit out of kids. It's a piece of content where they watch it and they go, that looks like great fun. That's made me laugh. That looks like, we're doing that. I want to do that. I want to play that. And that level of like children's content, you know, in the right place, delivered in the right way, the right kind of storytelling, not everybody's capable of delivering it for perfectly good reasons, but that's the gap that we fill.
Mm. Where's the balance between, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of eyes cast from the sports industry across to other media organizations that have a very strong track record of delivering family and kid-focused entertainment. That could be Nickelodeon, it could be Disney, it could be the BBC is obviously an excellent example as well. Where's the balance between kind of trying to ape or just kind of implant yourself in that type of storytelling and finding something that's innate in sport, as you know, as you're talking about, that translates then to a younger audience?
One of the easiest ways to do it is to sort of jump on everybody else's bandwagon, right? So, you know, you do partnerships or that horrible world collabs with somebody that's already doing it, and you inject a sense of what sport has got is an incredible kit of parts to make children excited and interested. You know, they've got wonderful sporting products with great drama and narrative. And don't get me wrong, sometimes that's dead boring, but sometimes it could be really great drama and narrative. You've got the pinnacle of like athletic performance and young, you know, fairly young adults in their 20s are young to me now. So you've got young adults who are aspirational in loads of ways. And then you've got sort of events that look great because they might have, you know, big crowds, loads of eyeballs, everything else. So they've like got all of the right ingredients to be able to sort of pitch into and make a mark, I think, with young audiences. Inevitably, it sometimes comes down to budget. You know, so if you want to have a really ambitious YouTube series where it's 8 minutes and everything else, well, you end up finding that YouTube is a really, really hungry beast and you can't afford to sustain it. However, by the same token, using some of those young athletes as platforms themselves and helping them be better on it rather than just sort of giving them loads of rules of what not to do and how it shouldn't affect their performance and everything else. Actually, if you like thinking about the possibilities of like a load of satellite entry points. And I'll give you an example is when I was at BBC Sport, we knew that. So if this is the center of the circle is BBC Sport and everybody comes to it because it's BBC Sport and everybody bloody loves BBC Sport, even though they were starting not to back then, however. Right. And if you want a deeper relationship, you'll go Garth Crooks' team of the week, analysis piece, whatever it might be, pundit piece. And you kind of build out from the spokes. In the world of children and younger audiences, all of those outside bits of the circle are satellite entry points into your sport. And they might be, there might be music, it might be culture, it might be, I don't know, it might be a political viewpoint, it might be health and fitness, it might be fashion, it might be all sorts of different ways in, but all of those are potential entry points back into the sport. And those are the bits that I think sports organizations need to embrace more. It's like, right, okay. I mean, I've never seen like a Mo Salah playlist. Like, what does Mo Salah listen to? Or what does whoever it is pick, you know, if that kind of stuff was part of your armory, what's Mo Salah's diet every day? If you want to eat like Mo Salah or train like Mo Salah, or all of that sort of stuff. And we see some clubs having a go at it and tapping into quite a lot of bits and pieces. But I think there's loads to be done around that, loads.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it comes back to, you know, a couple of things we touched on about the size of media teams and also the incentives to be intentional about your storytelling over the last 30 years have maybe not been there. The thing that's been most valuable is that live piece, because that's the bit that you bundle up and, and sell. And it's a, you know, for lots of sports organizations and then also the media companies that buy their rights. That's the big bit. And I suppose now if you're entering an age where you've got to grab your audience from all different places, you do have to think a little bit more around that live piece. And I suppose the thing with young audiences is it can be years before they're even a part of that live audience. You know, a 6-7-year-old who's obsessed with football, even when I was a kid, not necessarily going to sit down and watch a 90-minute game, even though by the time they're 12, 13, 14, that might be the kind of center of their fandom.
And the reality, right, is that the majority of kids who are fans of a sport are never going to get to see the sport live, or very rarely.
Yeah.
You know, so if you've got, I don't know, say a football match at this end and a football match at this end of the week, I don't think that those two things are the problem. The problem is the bit in the middle, because that's where you're competing for engagement and emotional connection and everything else. Everything comes back to storytelling. I bore people that I work with sort of saying like, everything is storytelling, and apart from storytelling, and that's about people. You know, and it is just about driving connections. And telling great stories in great ways, and whether it's not, it's participatory and just enabling people to feel a part of that and feel involved and part of a community. Because I think at its worst, sport just sort of sport assumes that everybody bloody loves sport. And the reality is that I'm what we used to call in BBC Sport a main eventer. I'm not a sports geek. I'm a sports fan, you know. I don't watch nearly as much sport as I probably should do. And I watch, you know, so England played at the weekend. I didn't watch it. I didn't watch the French Open final. Now, if I was a sports geek, I'd have been all over those things. But even me, as somebody who works in the sports industry, I was doing other stuff, you know, and I've seen the main bits and I've caught all the highlights and I've seen the competition for time is like, I think Monday to Friday. And if you get involved and engaged, you will then watch the live sport. But the bit in between, you know, how do you wake? What's your relationship with, I don't know, I'm a Man United fan, so let's take Man United. What's my relationship with Man United between 7 and 9 before I go to school, or before I go to work in my case. And then when I come home and I get my phone again at 3:30 until 9 p.m. when I go to bed, what's my relationship with Man United? Mm. What is there for me that I can engage with and participate in?
Yeah, yeah. You've mentioned a couple of examples, but what are some projects that you've worked on with Lucky Socks, some storytelling projects that you're particularly proud of, and what can they tell us about storytelling when it comes to younger audiences?
Oh, that's a good question. The project we've been working on that's frankly absolutely flown all season long is we've been making the social media video for Planet Football. And Planet Football is a really good example. It's a great team. They do sort of Planet Rugby, Planet Football. They've got a few similar titles. Planet Sport Group out of Leeds. Great team to work with, but they didn't have a whole load of experience with video. And when we started talking to them, what they wanted to do was tap into young adults. So, you know, 18 to 24 year olds, they want to grow their brand off platform, but also they wanted to stick to their brand. So their brand on Planet Football, one of their strengths is like trivia-based football quizzes. So we went, right, okay, well, we need to stick to the football-based trivia quizzes. But in the world of social media, what you can't do is like double down on geekdom, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a competition about who knows the most about Crystal Palace's left back, whatever. What you have to do in the world of social media is find stuff that's dead relatable and entertaining and funny first. And this is back to the young audience model that we've got. How do you make it entertaining? And then do stuff that like feel that goes up and out and feels relatable. So since the start of the season, we've had something like, for our content, about 150 million views, millions of engagements. Their TikTok account has now sort of gone through 3 million likes. It was under 1 million when we started working with them. So they've had all sorts of like really big wins on their accounts. But that has come for our part, and they've clearly done other stuff as well. From our part, it's come from making relatable but entertaining football video. That's relatable to the audience but sticks to their brand. You know, some of our biggest hits have been what might seem almost like quite silly ideas to some extent, like, you know, name the footballer from the body part, footballer from a tattoo, dead basic ideas, but you don't need to be a football geek to get involved. And we've also done some like fun stuff like, you know, name the footballer before he went to Turkey. So we've kind of done, you know, the hair transplant. And just sometimes you can overthink stuff, but it's what we've also done is like we've done some formats that have been really good, you know, whether or not it's like formats that keep you waiting till the end. So we've had some really good successes with that. And that's probably a good example, really, of taking a brand, because there's loads of stuff you can do on social media. And frankly, we could have had a load more like fun-based stuff, but it would have taken us away from the Planet Football brand. So making sure that you stay true to a brand's values and what they stand for on their platforms, as well as growing them off platforms, is a real balance. So that's been a sort of a fun project to be involved with.
Yeah. And then looking away from what you guys do, what's the kind of gold standard that you'd point to, or what's a really exciting project in that kind of youth-focused sports storytelling space? Because it's an easy thing to get wrong. It's an easy thing to miss the mark. It's an easy thing to be cringe and to not give your audience enough credit. There's a whole load of things that you can miss, and there's also a massive opportunity if you get it right.
I think there is a massive opportunity, and I know there are things going on that will change the face of like youth content in the next couple of years in sport, across various different things that and various different places. But I guess it's like, it's a vibe to tap into at the moment. So if you look at sort of the Ballers League, and not, I'll be honest, not as a wonderful piece of storytelling, but as a really good example of how to tap into the way that a young audience feels about sport. So when you watch the Ballers League, some of the biggest cheers are for like a bit of skill. You know, it's not for the, frankly, this nobody goes to watch the Ballers League and they're not watching it because they're seeing the greatest football they've ever seen. They're seeing it because it's like feels like entertainment and it's cool, and it's so it's tapping into and adapting your sport in a different way, and we're seeing that across a number of other people now, sort of going, how can we have something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. But because that is the first steps into sport just embracing a new like front door to their sport. And I don't subscribe to this notion that the Ballers League, that it's not going to replace football, not by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just a nice little add-on. It's a different mm-hmm. way. You know, it's almost like it's a modern Panini sticker book. It's just a different way of being engaged with football alongside the main thrust of football.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really, really interesting way of reframing it. Right. I know you've got to jump in a couple of minutes. So a few questions that we're asking everyone on the podcast. The first one is, do you have, and I think this is particularly pertinent in your case, do you have a kind of origin story or something that kind of sparked your interest in sport in the first place?
I've been a sports fan my whole life. I played average sports at a very average level as a kid. Now I'm too old for sport. I'm a big runner. But I'm a huge believer in that sport teaches you most things about life, you know, win, lose, resilience, teamwork, everything. And I think that's kind of one of the missions of Lucky Socks is how can we play a part in just getting more young people active?
Yeah. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
That is a great question. I mean, I'm tempted to say Escape to Victory, but I think I would one of the best campaigns I've seen in the past 10 years or so is probably This Girl Can, mm-hmm. which remains for me just totally original and totally different and absolutely fundamentally relatable with the audience it was targeting, you know. And that's a real trick. I think there's lots to learn even now from that campaign.
Yeah. And what's finally a sports story you'd like to tell or you'd love to see someone else tell?
Oh, that's a good one. Do you know what? I'm kind of fascinated by the whole stamina runner. You know, like, you know, I was fascinated watching the Eliud Kipchoge of how he like gone to 2 hours, that whole kind of thing when he did that with Ineos and whatnot. I would love to see actually now, and this isn't in the kids' space at all, but a bit more about the sort of almost like the biochemistry impacts on the body of exercise and how just to unlock it a little bit more. I'm quite a bit of I'm fascinated by that kind of science geeky side of sport.
Yeah. And what about on that kid's side? I mean, what would, you know, if it was your family or someone else, what's a story you love to be able to relate to them that perhaps hasn't been already?
That's difficult because I think I've sort of almost seen just about every story that has tried to be told. I think what would be really good is I would love to see a proper, real deep dive into how Premier League academies spot children. You know, yeah. we sort of, you know, because we're in Manchester, right? So it's quite a hot spot for that. But like the work that goes into identifying a 6-year-old and their physiology and why at 6 you think when they get to 18 they've got a chance. And just that whole sense of do clubs do it right and do they look after children? And, you know, because I think there's lots of kids that kind of get spat out in the hunt for a £50 million footballer. I think that would be a fascinating thing to look at. And I'm not casting aspersions either way. I just think it would be a fascinating subject.
Yeah. Okay. And well, I mean, when, you know, do you think that that's something that there's something when you think about kids at that age more generally, and the doubts they have about themselves and the things that they're working through and all the rest of it. Do you think that that's something that's valuable to them? Or are you thinking of that kind of more like through an industry lens?
I think more just through the family lens. I mean, what's interesting now in the children's industry space is that lots of people are leaning towards family viewing, you know? So I've got an 11-year-old stepson who's like, you know, a big Liverpool fan, he's mad on football, plays football. I think be the sort of thing that he'd want to sit down and watch if it was told in the right way.
Yeah.
So what I'm envisaging a sort of panorama grown up to grown up sort of deep piece like that. But I just think it would be a fascinating sort of documentary of getting under the skin of an academy properly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, who knows? Maybe that's a project that's in somebody's future, but yeah, Stu, it's been a fascinating 45 minutes, and thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been great to chat. Cheers, Owen.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.